President Trump and Kim Jong-un have a special relationship. What does North Korea do if Joe Biden becomes president?
I would not be surprised if North Korea returns to a range of weapons testing.
What's at stake for North Korea in this presidential election? I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Madrid is seeing a wave of coronavirus cases just as kids go back to school.
I am so angry, so tired, so scared. And I have the feeling that we are fighting alone.
And some good climate news today from Europe.
This is pretty significant. I think this is a lot more than what we would have hoped just a year ago. So this was pretty huge.
Greater ambitions to fight climate change, all that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us today. The Spanish capital, Madrid, is seeing one of Europe's worst second-wave coronavirus outbreaks right now. Residents like Beatriz Garcia Rios say they feel like local officials have just left them alone to fend for themselves.
Nobody's supporting us. That while we try to get on with our lives, not touching anybody, and always on your guard, always afraid, there is no one there. It is a complete disaster.
Miguel Hernan says Madrid could benefit from looking at New York City's efforts to beat back a second wave. Hernan is an epidemiologist with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Madrid and New York City were on very similar trajectories earlier on in the pandemic. They were both hit hard back in March. How much did Madrid and New York have in common when they set out to battle this virus?
They are big cities. They're very dense. They have a large network of public transit. They have hundreds of thousands or millions of visitors per month. And both had a very explosive outbreak of coronavirus that overwhelmed their contact tracing system, their hospitals, to the point that a lockdown was needed to bring down the number of cases. And in June, both cities had very low number of cases.
Right. By June, each city had bounced back, but now they've diverged spectacularly. What is the data telling us now about how New York and Madrid compare?
The second wave in Madrid is very, very high. So we can look at the number of people who are at the ICU. And if you look at that, you see that where that number in New York City is very low. It's not even reported or used as a criterion now because it's very, very low. More than 50%, 50, of the ICU beds in Madrid are now occupied by COVID-19 patients.
Wow. So how do you explain, Miguel, Madrid's failures in comparison to New York City?
There are many differences. One of them is the number of tests. Both cities doing the worst of the epidemic. Both cities had more than 70% of people tested were positive, and that's a huge number. The number in Madrid is now over 20%, but in New York it's less than 1%, which tells you that the number of tests is not as high as it should be in Madrid. Besides that, the number of people that have been hired for contact tracing is an order of magnitude larger in New York than in Madrid. Also, there is the issue of the speed of the reopening of business, of course.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you, the poor corners of Madrid, where social distancing is difficult, it's especially hard hit, which squares with a trend worldwide. And yet children from those neighborhoods are going back to school in person. Is that wise?
We will see very soon. The problem is that having children in school when the contact tracing system is not up to speed and the number of tests available may not be sufficient is especially dangerous in a city like Madrid, in which many families live in households with three generations.
What about indoor dining in Madrid? Is that becoming a thing again?
It has become a thing since June, and that is one of the biggest differences between Madrid and New York City. Indoor dining opened in Madrid together with bar service. It opened at 60%, but the enforcement of that was light. Whereas in New York City, there is no indoor dining. It will open on September 30th with no bar service. And that may explain a lot of the differences between Madrid and New York City.
Well, we do know that indoor dining and bar service are some of the riskiest behaviors one can undertake in the pandemic. Miguel Hernan is an epidemiologist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is a vast desert sitting above an underground sea of oil. Now it appears the Saudis may have a lot of uranium as well, enough reserves for their own domestic source of nuclear fuel. That's what The Guardian is reporting. These are inferred uranium deposits that would need to be further explored to confirm that they're really there and figure out the cost of extraction. But let's play what if. Andrea Stricker is a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
So these reports are troubling, that Saudi Arabia is prospecting for uranium with the assistance of China, and that they've uncovered these significant deposits. Uranium, of course, is the precursor material to making nuclear fuel, but can also be used for either nuclear energy production or nuclear weapons. And U.S. intelligence leaked to the media in August more concerning information about secret facilities.
What did they say?
They believe the Saudis are building a uranium mine and mill, also with China's help, and that they may have a uranium conversion facility. So usually when U.S. intelligence leaks things to the media, it's because they feel like policymakers are not taking it seriously.
What has the kingdom said about its nuclear ambitions, either as an energy source or for nuclear weapons?
Well, they started doing this a few years ago, laying the basis for what they say will be a vast nuclear energy program. They say it's going to be for electricity production and other civilian applications. They claim they want to diversify and that this program will be peaceful and not used for nuclear weapons.
Are Saudi Arabia's nuclear ambitions, do they have anything to do with kind of being a counterweight to Iran?
The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has pledged to match Iran's nuclear capabilities, which include the most sensitive process of uranium enrichment. So Iran has it. Saudi Arabia wants to have that to hedge and have equal capabilities. If they do seek to match Iran, however, Iran had an advanced nuclear weapons program up until about 2003. It maintains all of that knowledge and could make nuclear weapons in under 2 years if it chose to do so. So the Saudis do need to hurry if they do want to match Iran on that level.
That kind of puzzled me. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman declared in 2018 that if Iran develops a nuclear bomb, that, quote, we will follow suit as soon as possible. We know MBS to be an ambitious leader. Is he really waiting for Iran to announce first that they have a bomb without having one in place?
Well, they have a lot at stake. I mean, they have a close relationship with the United States. They would basically have to sacrifice that partnership if they chose to go for nuclear weapons. They would almost certainly unite the world against them with sanctions and demands to stop. So, I mean, they do have to consider their future if they make that kind of a move.
Andrea, you also mentioned China. It's Chinese geologists who've been working to map Saudi Arabia's uranium reserves. What is China's interest in this?
They've prioritized the economic factor first and foremost, and they've never been a good, responsible state with regard to preventing nuclear proliferation. They helped Pakistan's nuclear weapons program. Basically, up until the 90s, they would sell anything to anyone. They helped Iran's nuclear weapons program in the past. So they really just go for their own economic interests.
So how concerned should the U.S. be about Saudi Arabia's nuclear ambitions?
We should be very concerned. What we need first is stronger eyes on the Saudi nuclear program. They have weak safeguards in place, and they don't have adequate inspections with the UN nuclear watchdog. And if they have nothing to hide, we shouldn't be learning about all these activities from the media. We also need robust U.S. diplomacy to convince them not to go down this road, or else our bilateral relationship with them could end. And I think, finally, there are major implications for the Middle East and nuclear proliferation. It would be much harder to demand that Iran roll back its enrichment program and then to keep states like Turkey and Egypt from pursuing advanced nuclear capabilities if the Saudis make this leap.
Andrea Stricker is a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Trade wars, diplomatic squabbling, journalist visas canceled, and plenty of name-calling. With each passing week, it seems the relationship between the U.S. and China gets more and more contentious. It's stressful for diplomats and business people from both places, but it's also created headaches for couples who are from both countries. The world's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai would know because she's American and her husband is Chinese.
When my family all sits down to dinner these days, a question my kids sometimes ask is, why can't China and the U.S. just get along? Many cross-national Chinese and American couples are asking that same question. I visited William Wong and his American partner, Kit Menchen, in their Shanghai apartment. They've been together for about a year now.
We met on Tinder, as is often the case. On the first date, I actually stood him up.
Yeah. After 1 week, he contacted me again, so we went out for dinner.
The plan was for them to move to the U.S. together this year. But, well, COVID.
Because everything happened when it did, we kind of put everything on hold and we're just here for the time being.
But it's not just the pandemic. The relationship between China and the U.S. has been testy, to say the least. And that's made it harder to imagine a life together in America.
I think it could be much more difficult for him to find a job or to get a visa. We think that the hoops we would have to jump through would be much more difficult. Yeah, I wouldn't say that marriage was off the table, but that's also a very long process.
Are you going to propose on this? I was like, no.
Politics and the upcoming elections sneak into their conversation sometimes after a few drinks. Don't bring up Hong Kong with these two. But like many Chinese-American cross-national couples, Kit says things go better when they don't talk about that elephant in the room. Their approach? Keep it fun and try to understand the other person's point of view.
I just like to think about my relationship with William, you know, and depoliticize it, I guess. I wouldn't say it's a politics-free zone, this living room, but we try and it's a light touch.
I'm going to tell him we're going to watch Netflix later.
Yeah.
It'll be fine. Don't overthink it. Yeah.
Teresa Decker is an American therapist who has worked with couples and families in Shanghai for the past 7 years. She sees a lot of cross-national couples struggling to work out their differences. The rising tensions between the U.S. and China can add pressure to already tough challenges, she says.
When you think about your countries cutting each other off, which is a lot of times what is being threatened right now. What does that mean for going back and forth? What does that mean for being with your family and being with his family? What does that mean for your kids and being with your grandparents? I think it's an unbelievable stress.
Each couple manages that stress in different ways. In a downtown Starbucks, Chris Wong and his wife Yuhan are grabbing a coffee together on their lunch break. The two have been together for about 4 years now and are expecting their second child. They say parenting doesn't leave much time to think about politics. They focus more on their family. But differences between their two cultures do seep into their relationship. One of the things they fight about? Air conditioning.
I guess the general belief here in China by many, many people is that 26 degrees Celsius...
That's 79 degrees Fahrenheit.
...is the best temperature to turn AC, regardless of the temperature outside, regardless of, you know, how hot it is.
That's not exactly what Chris finds comfortable.
Turn down to 24 or 23, then, you know, we'll have a fight over the remote. Well, I'll turn it down, and then, you know, once I leave the room, and then, you know, I'll get turned back to 26.
They usually try to compromise, and they wish the U.S. and China could figure out how to do that, too.
Looking at the news, it's just not very, comforting.
Watching the U.S. and China fight over policy, trade insults, and block economic activity, they have some advice. You can't just break up.
Because we are now, we are so globalized, and you say, I just want to have nothing to do with you, that's not going to happen. Climate, finances, business, everything ties together. It's like when you marry like 40 years, you have 5 kids together. It's like, I don't want to see you ever again. That's not going to happen.
Chris and Yuhan, along with many other cross-cultural couples, hope that their home countries can figure out a way to de-escalate their conflicts before things get worse. That includes my own cross-national family. We feel deeply connected to both China and the U.S. It pains us to see them fight, and it puts our household at risk. Even my 8-year-old daughter has some thoughts on this. I have to get along with my brother every day, she says. So you'd think two countries could figure it out. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. This has been a tough week for climate change news here in the U.S. Wildfires in the West fed by dry and hot conditions, a hurricane that stalled out over the Gulf Coast. We're going to spend the next few minutes on some good news out of Europe in our weekly look at climate change solutions, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now
and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, joins me now. Hey, Carolyn.
Hey, Marco.
So I gather the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen made some news on your beat in Brussels yesterday.
That's right. Von der Leyen gave her first State of the Union speech yesterday, which was, as you would expect, all about how Europe would pull itself out of the health and economic crises caused by the pandemic. But what was interesting was how she really doubled down on the idea that the road to recovery really led through green investments.
As we pull through together, we must also propel ourselves forward in the world of tomorrow. And there is no more urgent need for acceleration than when it comes to the future of our fragile planet.
Von der Leyen announced a new target for greenhouse gas emission reductions, Marco, cutting emissions by 55% by 2030. That's up from 40% in a previous target that was set just 6 years ago. That actually exceeds what scientists say we need to do in order to keep warming below a degree and a half Celsius. And it is roughly double as ambitious as the U.S. target that was agreed to in the Paris Agreement for 2025.
Is this new target a done deal or just a line in a speech?
The target is subject to debate. European heads of state are going to have to sign on. But the ambition of it kind of surprised even people who really follow these issues, like Manon Dufour, who heads up the Brussels office of a European climate think tank called E3G.
This is pretty significant. I think this is a lot more than what we would have hoped just a year ago. So this was pretty huge.
Carolyn, what happened in the past year that made the EU beef up this target?
There's a couple of factors. European will is stronger now to be acting more ambitiously on climate change, partially spurred by activists like the Fridays for Future Kids striking each Friday. Costs for renewables are coming down. Von der Leyen seems to be trying to position the European Commission to step into some of the leadership void on climate change that's been left by the United States backing away from it. But also the impact of the pandemic itself is being seen as a driver here.
Explain that. How so?
Well, Ursula von der Leyen announced this European Green Deal back in December. But when the pandemic hit, there was real concern by its supporters that the investments and initiatives that would need to be launched to make it happen would be derailed. And it looks like actually kind of the opposite has happened. Here's Manon Dufour again.
The COVID crisis could have disrupted this, but in a way it accelerated the transition and the commitment. It was already like the intention that green was a kind of a growth strategy. And I think at the time where they really needed a growth strategy and a recovery strategy, green became like the obvious choice.
So funding for that growth strategy will come partly from 30% of recovery funds that von der Leyen announced yesterday would come from green bonds.
Really interesting. So I know there are other threads of this story, Carolyn, that you've been following. For example, how the pandemic is impacting emissions directly and energy companies. Beyond this recovery plan, any news on that front?
There was a bit of news that was made on that front as well this week. BP said in its annual Energy Outlook report that we might have already hit peak oil last year in 2019, and it also revised down substantially its global energy demand figures going forward, citing both the economic downturn coming from the coronavirus pandemic and also predicting that some of the habits that we've changed due to the pandemic, like working from home, are going to stick around. So, ongoing story here, but clearly the climate impacts of this pandemic are something to keep watching.
The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler. Thanks, as always.
Thank you, Marco.
Last November, Venice, Italy had a real scare, the worst floods in more than half a century. They were a reminder that the floating city is especially vulnerable to climate change and sea level rise. Now a team of artists and scientists are working together to create a model of Venice. The goal is to preserve the city digitally just as it is. Adam Lowe leads his project at the Factum Foundation for Digital Technology in Conservation and joins us from Madrid. What made you want to create this record of San Giorgio Maggiore Island in Venice? What was the catalyst for this project?
You described the floods in Venice last year. That were followed by droughts when the canals dried up. But then COVID struck, so all the tourists were absent. And it meant that one of my teams, who was meant to be going to carry out another recording project in another part of the world, had some time. So I said, let's set up the team and actually demonstrate that in 3 weeks we can record the whole of the island inside and outside. The island of San Giorgio is about 10 hectares, but really three of the real masterpieces of northern Italian architecture are there on the island. And we thought, well, OK, if Venice is under so much threat and we have to build an accurate model, why don't we take the island of San Giorgio as our barometer and say, what can we actually do in 3 weeks recording the island?
Adam, is the intent of this project preservation of the buildings in Venice, or is it tracking sea level rise and climate change?
It's twofold. So obviously sea level rise has an impact on the preservation of the buildings. And one of the problems that Venice faces is the Venetians really knew how to build. So the way the buildings are actually designed and constructed sets them up on piles, on wooden piles driven into the lagoon with marble caps, with the brickwork built on top of the marble. But due to the change in sea level, the water is now over the top of the marble and is rotting the brickwork. What we're interested in doing is creating this three-dimensional model that is accurate enough for us to be able to monitor both where the water is at different times, so that can be mapped on in a dynamic way onto the model we build, but also look at the effects of that water on the buildings. And by extension, if we move into the next phase that I hope will start fairly soon, is piece by piece recording the whole of the city. So really the goal is to set up a three-dimensional, high-resolution map of the whole of the city of Venice.
Given what you've been seeing in Venice, how bad could things get there in the next 10 years?
I always like to think very positively, and I like to think that when people focus on a subject with the right tools, they'll find the right solutions for preserving the object. And really, there are always solutions, but really you have to have the objective data to allow people to have the right analysis and to collectively come to positive decisions about how to preserve things. Venice is definitely in quite a critical state.
Adam Lowe is the founder of the Factum Foundation for Digital Technology in Conservation. He and his team are creating a high-tech model of Venice to track sea level rise. Adam, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The World. Wildfires on the West Coast have created some of the worst air quality on the planet. Immigrant farm workers are still showing up to work.
You can see we can't even look at the sky because it's like full of smoke around us.
Choosing between your health and a paycheck. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Lots of people are ready for November 3rd to get here. World leaders everywhere are also anxious to see the outcome of the U.S. presidential race. That may be especially true for Kim Jong-un. The North Korean leader has had an unusual connection with President Trump. They've met face-to-face three times and exchanged personal letters. How would a Biden administration deal with Kim differently? The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
North Korea has said Joe Biden is an idiot, that he's in the final stage of dementia, and that he's a, quote, rabid dog that should be beaten to death. So Pyongyang's feelings about Biden, not a mystery, says Doo-Yun Kim from the International Crisis Group.
It clearly sounds like Pyongyang has no regard, does not think highly of Biden at all.
Not that Biden has kind words for Kim Jong-un. Here he is at a campaign rally.
Are we a nation that embraces dictators and tyrants like Putin and Kim Jong-un? We don't, but Trump does.
So what happens if Biden wins and it's his job to somehow take away Kim Jong-un's most prized possession, his nuclear weapons? Well, we might see some drama soon after the election, says Doo-Yun Kim.
If Biden is elected, then I would not be surprised if North Korea returns to a range of weapons testing.
She means the heavier weapons, the scarier ones, maybe long-range missiles, the ones North Korea is always dying to test and improve. She even has a time frame for this.
The time between election day and inauguration day.
Now, this makes sense, because putting the U.S. in crisis mode, that would give Kim Jong-un leverage to say, oh, Biden, you want to negotiate? Well, I'll stop these tests if America gives up something in return. Since Trump and Kim Jong-un made nice, North Korea has mostly backed off, testing nukes or long-range missiles. But they're now getting annoyed. They think the U.S. owes them something for this, according to Sung-ho Shin of Seoul National University.
From North Korean perspective, that's a big concession they have made.
So what does North Korea really want, anyway? Well, for starters, they want less of this. U.S.-South Korea war games, which North Korea sees as a rehearsal for invasion. Under Trump, the U.S. military has stopped doing some of the biggest war games. Professor Shin says Pyongyang assumes they are gone for good.
From the North Korean perspective, that's a done deal.
It's a done deal. So what North Korea really wants now is to get rid of the crushing sanctions from the U.S. and the U.N. that shut them out of the global economy. America is probably not going to budge on that unless North Korea gets rid of some of its nukes. And there's only one guy who can make that decision about the nuclear weapons.
North Korean negotiators are not allowed to talk about that. They always say it's up to Kim Jong-un. But that's a crucial core element for Team America.
This gets tricky for Biden, whose North Korea policy is honestly pretty vague. But he has said that he's not going to do flashy Trump-style summits that go nowhere. He'd want negotiators to hammer out a deal before he shows up. But to move forward, on the nukes at least, Biden himself might have to do a face-to-face meeting with Kim Jong-un.
If North Korean negotiators are not allowed to talk about the nuclear issue, then only Kim Jong-un and an American president will have to talk about that.
Even if Biden does say, okay, fine, let's meet, Do-Yun Kim says it might be Kim Jong-un who refuses. Because since the Trump meetings didn't get rid of sanctions, North Korea has been sounding more irritated, giving more ultimatums, even issuing this demand after a U.S. official called them a rogue nation. They basically said,
America and American officials cannot call us names. If you call us names, we will not show up at the table.
Yep, the fate of North Asia could hinge on name calling. Of course, Joe Biden is less of a name caller than Trump, who last year joined Kim Jong-un in mocking Biden.
Well, Kim Jong-un made a statement that Joe Biden is a low IQ individual. He probably is, based on his record.
No matter what, if Biden wins, there will be some tension if and when he reaches out to Kim Jong-un. So the first person Team Biden might want to approach is not Kim Jong-un. It's one of his top advisors, his sister, Kim Yo-jong. That's Kim Yo-jong meeting South Korean President Moon Jae-in 2 years ago, with cameras popping. It's one of very few clips of her voice. As Professor Shin says, talking about the Kim siblings,
trust between those two runs very deep.
The trust runs so deep that a potential Biden White House should make contacting Kim Yo-jong a priority, says Do-Yun Kim.
It might be best to also aim for reaching his sister to try to get any type of either headway or understanding about North Korean thinking. I think we can expect to see and hear from Kim Yo-jong more often.
Here's the bottom line. Biden and Trump are wildly different when it comes to demeanor, yes. But Do-Yun Kim points out,
every American administration has basically followed the same broad policy toward North Korea.
The U.S. wants North Korea to give up its nukes. The Kim dynasty holds on to them for dear life. Yet both sides are very hesitant to spark a horrific war. So that's it. They're stuck, calling each other tyrants and idiots and rabid imperialist dogs. And so Do-Yun Kim says, no matter who wins the election,
I do not expect a drastic change in American policy toward North Korea, regardless of who is in the White House next year.
Still, on election night, Kim Jong-un and his team will probably be following the results along with the rest of us. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
How much do younger Americans know about the Holocaust? Not enough, according to results from a survey put out this week. The U.S. Millennial Holocaust Knowledge and Awareness Survey engaged with around 10,000 young people between the ages of 18 and 39 from all 50 states. But the widespread lack of knowledge about the mass extermination of 6 million Jews and other oppressed groups in Europe during World War II was significant. For instance, Auschwitz-Birkenau in Poland, the notorious death camp where more than a million people were murdered. More than half of the survey respondents said they did not know what Auschwitz-Birkenau was, and 11% said that Jews themselves caused the Holocaust. Gretchen Skidmore joins us. She's a director of the Levine Institute for Holocaust Education at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. What was your reaction when you saw these numbers?
Well, as you note, the gaps in Holocaust knowledge are certainly cause for concern, but more alarming are the high percentages of respondents saying that they believe Jews were responsible for the Holocaust, or that the Holocaust is a myth or exaggerated. So this Holocaust denial is a form of anti-Semitism, which is on the rise and dangerous.
So it's anecdotal, but I know many younger people who say they definitely learned about the Holocaust in school, reading books like The Diary of Anne Frank and Elie Wiesel's Night. It's being taught in some places. So why do so many of the survey respondents not seem to be familiar with aspects of the Holocaust?
Yeah, I think this study is a starting point to unpack some of that. But certainly history education generally is in decline. Social media is on the rise. And with the Holocaust receding in time, we're looking at what are the conditions, you know, that we really all need to be paying attention to have effective Holocaust education, and realizing that it's also important to have the history courses there or the English courses there, but is there sufficient time for preparation? Is there sufficient time for classroom instruction? Is there opportunity for teachers to have professional development around this complex history? Is there commitment from the local school district or the local community to teaching the history? There are a lot of conditions that make this possible.
So it sounds like it's not just a school problem, an education problem. What can you tell us about how knowledge of the Holocaust is being shared outside of school in wider communities?
Well, there certainly is an opportunity. For example, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum has a very vibrant Instagram page where we put aspects of the history of the Holocaust regularly, engaging students around certain concepts and themes in informal ways, you know, sort of meeting them where they are. There are opportunities to engage with accurate and accessible history. And there are many, many educational resources that are free and on our website. And we work with partners all across the country who reach out to students and their local museums and opportunities to study local connections. So there are many resources, but the local commitment is a critical component for its success.
And Gretchen, your job at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum is to educate a wide audience about the Holocaust. How do you design these educational experiences to make them the most impactful?
Well, we think a lot about individual stories, and whether that's testimony of a Holocaust survivor, or whether it's telling the story of an artifact from our collection, or if it's looking at a piece of archival footage and looking at the range of choices that people are making in that particular moment. There's a lot of really engaging materials, primary sources that we anchor all of our materials on. And I think just being able to think about primary sources, but also what are some of the key questions that not only can help understand the past, but can help us understand the present.
False information is being spread online constantly. How do you confront Holocaust deniers?
Well, Holocaust denial is a form of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism didn't end with the Holocaust. It didn't begin with the Holocaust. And working together, it is something that we have to continue to be vigilant about in presenting the facts of the history and presenting them in various platforms with various partners to make sure that they're available and that people can think critically about when the history is being distorted.
So if there's this really negative combination of a failure of education and disinformation and fake news, what do we have to do to fix this to ensure that the next generation of young people will know more about the Holocaust?
Well, I'm not sure I would characterize it as a failure of education. I think that there is a very important statistic in here that says some 83% of students find the study of the Holocaust important, and they think it's important to continue to study about it in school. And I think that what we can see here is that history is always relevant, and the history of the Holocaust is always relevant. Students are recognizing that, and we need to meet them where they are and make sure they have the information in their social media or in their classrooms so that we can continue to give them the opportunity to think critically about the lessons and their roles and responsibilities today.
Gretchen Skidmore is a director at the Levine Institute for Holocaust Education at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. Thank you very much, Gretchen.
Thank you so much.
Before we go to our next story, let me fill you in on one more way we can connect. Start your morning with us. We'll get you news stories from around the globe on the early side. How? Our newsletter. It's called Top of the World. You get it weekdays right in your inbox. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. The fires in the West have been catastrophic. At least 27 people are dead, millions of acres of land torched, and the skies above parts of California, Oregon, and Washington blanketed in toxic smoke. Some people, many of them immigrants, are now being forced to choose between their health and a paycheck. The World's Monica Campbell spoke with some immigrant farm workers about the difficult choices in front of them right now.
The air was so thick in southern Oregon, it was like a whiteout, burning your eyes and throat. But Maricela kept working, harvesting grapes for Merlot wine. She sent me a video of herself working an 8-hour shift outside. Her hands move so fast, the video seems sped up. She's careful to protect the tiny grapes, but protecting herself from the smoke around her, that comes second. She can't afford to miss work, she says. She makes $12 an hour, has bills to pay, and wires all she can to feed her kids in Mexico. Normally, she likes her boss, but right now, she's angry. I have to choose between my health and a paycheck, she says. Her boss apologized, but the grapes needed picking. To speak openly, Maricela asked me not to say her last name or where she works. She worries she could get fired. This reality, along with notoriously weak labor regulations, have kept farm workers breathing toxic smoke all along the West Coast. Estela Cisneros is an advocate with California Rural Legal Assistance. She says that many farm workers are particularly sensitive to smoke.
Because they have pre-existing health conditions, because they have low socioeconomic status, because they have less access to health care, they're already vulnerable to the negative effects of prolonged exposure and inhalation of smoke.
I asked Doug Parker about this. He leads California's Division of Occupational Safety and Health, CalOSHA. He says if the air quality index tops 150, considered unhealthy, then employers must provide respirators, those N95 masks, which are sturdier and have a small filter. But many farm workers say that's not happening.
That's disturbing to me. It's the employer's obligation to provide protective equipment to employees, plain and simple.
If masks are available, it's up to workers to decide to wear them. It's voluntary. They're not required unless the air quality index, or AQI, tops 500. For context, on some of the worst days of smoke on the West Coast, the AQI was in the 300s. You definitely didn't go outside if you didn't have to. Parker wishes he had stronger tools to protect farm workers, but he says he simply doesn't have enough enforcement officers to sweep every agricultural site in California to flag violations.
I would really like to hear from workers more about those situations.
It can be hard for some farm workers to speak up if they're undocumented or have flimsy contracts or no union. One man, who didn't want his name on air, kept harvesting almonds in Fresno, California, even as smoke filled the area from a massive fire. He says his farm didn't provide masks, although he's heard that some do. I told him about an anonymous tip line that workers can call if employers aren't following the rules.
No. Yo me imagino que al...
I wouldn't call that number, he says. What if it gets traced back to me? That's a big concern for farm worker advocates. So when possible, they try to help in person.
Let me turn the camera here. You can see we can't even look at the sky because it's like full of smoke around us.
In Oregon, I talk with Daisy Bedoya over a video call. She's with a nonprofit that helps farm workers south of Portland. All week, Bedoy has been passing out face masks and bags of donated food to evacuees and to people who've managed to not work because of the smoke.
We have an assembly line of food, anything from protein bars, granola, coffee.
One couple approaches the donation table.
¿Están trabajando en el campo?
Sí.
We're here for help, the man says, standing next to his pregnant wife. Bedoya asks if they work in the fields. Yes, they say, but not today. Our boss said stay home. Bedoya hopes the donations will make it easier for more people to do that. She understands the realities. Her family worked on farms after migrating from Mexico.
Picking berries as well. I've done it. My brother has done it.
She knows farm workers are not always protected, even now, with smoke swirling all around.
They're having to work outside in really hard conditions. It's very frustrating that they're always the ones that are put at the end and the last ones that people think of. So that's how I feel about it.
But Bedoya also feels thankful for all the people who've made donations and who are trying to keep farm workers safe. For The World, Monica Campbell.
This week marks the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower Voyage.
Having already endured great trial and tribulation, children, women, and men, pilgrims alike, set sail into the unknown.
A commemoration on Wednesday in Plymouth, England, where the voyage began. The U.S. ambassador to the U.K., Woody Johnston, was there.
It was four centuries ago today, after the famous Mayflower voyage across the Atlantic, the U.S. and the U.K. are once again setting sail from Plymouth to make history.
Once again, because there's a new collaborative project underway. The U.S. and the U.K. are launching a modern-day Mayflower that's part of a research mission on climate change, pollution, and conservation.
The Mayflower autonomous ship.
Meaning this vessel will have no crew and no passengers. It's powered by solar energy and controlled by artificial intelligence. It's all part of a bigger project called Plymouth 400. The goal is to highlight aspects of Native American history that have been whitewashed in the past. Here's Professor Margaret Bruchak. She's a coordinator of the Indigenous Studies Initiative at the University of Pennsylvania.
Plymouth 400 is focused more than ever on allowing Wampanoag histories to take center stage, allowing Wampanoag people to be heard, allowing Wampanoag perspectives to be respected, and recognizing that they are Indigenous and they underlie everything else.
Of course, the Wampanoag people have lived in what's now called New England for thousands of years. With this 400-year anniversary of the Mayflower, the Wampanoag have an active role in helping plan events and curate new exhibitions.
So instead of being a series of events devoted to colonial settler memories and descendant celebrations, it's a year that constantly recognizes the fraught history of that colonial encounter.
Commemoration rather than celebration. As for the new autonomous Mayflower send-off, the vessel still needs to go through 6 months of sea trials before even attempting the Atlantic crossing, just like the original Mayflower did back in 1620. As soon as graduate student Dipo Oleyeye heard this song, he knew what his next research project was going to be.
My brother, my sister, papa, mama, pikin. Corona, no big passos, we go fight time, we go win. As long as we remember to always do the right thing. Wash your hands, love each other, we go win.
This is Nigerian musician Kabones Asukwo with his song We Go Win Coronavirus. It's one of the many tunes released by African artists that caught the ear of Dipo Oyeleye. Dipo's now researching the songs about COVID-19 from Nigeria and also Uganda, Congo, Ghana, many places on the continent. He's also tracing the impact these tracks are having. Dipo Oleyeye joins us from Madison, where he's a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin. So how many songs have come out from Africa that deal specifically with the coronavirus?
I've been able to gather over 50 tracks.
50, 5-0.
Yeah, from different artists on the continent.
When you started compiling the research, Dipo, were you surprised by the volume of song output?
Well, at first, I didn't pay too much attention to the numbers. I was just basically fascinated. A lot of artists using the moment to create music that actually helps to disseminate the right information to the general public.
I think about musicians here in the U.S., and I'm actually having a hard time thinking of one song by a mainstream pop artist that takes on COVID-19 as directly as some of the artists you've been listening to. There's Cardi B. She does videos where she talks about the virus. But why do you think African musicians have been so quick to use this song as a form to communicate concerns to people?
I think the first thing one would notice is that, you know, unlike other epidemics that have happened on the continent, this is a major one that also directly affects everybody, including the musicians. Some of them have to cancel their shows. I think the personal became political. And also, perhaps seeing people that they know pass away from the virus could also be another factor.
Right. Kind of respect for the people who've lost their lives. Are the songs also a response to lives lost to other pandemics like Ebola? Like, were there lessons learned from those other outbreaks?
Usually with something like Ebola, there's this thing with most governments on the continent using musicians to put out a song, sensitizing the public and all of that. So there has always been this idea of using, you know, music to disseminate information. So it's not entirely new. But what is different in this one is that it's not necessarily initiated by the governments. It's just, you know, individuals lending their voices to help prevent the spread of the virus.
As I went through some of the songs that address COVID-19, there's a mix of stylistic approaches. We heard Kabum's Asuquo from Nigeria with his song We Go Win Coronavirus a moment ago, which has practical advice about not shaking hands, about washing your hands. Other songs take a more humorous approach. And then there's Koffi Olomide from Congo, who has a song called Coronavirus Assassin. And in it, he's singing that the anger of God is what caused the coronavirus. So do you have a sense of what these different approaches to singing about COVID-19 have done to perceptions of the disease across the continent?
Yeah, I think one of the good things with having different ways of thinking about it is that it connects with different publics. There are songs that appeal to the sophisticated, those who are not educated enough to read guidelines and all of that. And some of them actually are meant for people who could only communicate in their local languages. And so there are artists who cater to that. So having different views and perspective.
Yeah, there's a little something in all these songs for everyone. Dipo Oyeleye, a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dipo, thanks for being with us. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
You can hear some of the coronavirus songs from various African artists and see the music videos at theworld.org.
Discipline and personal hygiene, and make sure you regularly wash your hands. Keep a distance from everyone. Report anything like a symptom. Serious fever is a symptom. Dry cough is a symptom. Walk with Tamala is a symptom. Itchy eyes and flu is a symptom.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, stay healthy. We'll be back with you here tomorrow.